Hi, it's Patrick here, and this pod is in need of twang. Ah, that's better. I'll be talking twang today with an American in Britain, linguist and blogger Lynn Murphy. As to whether her accent is twangy, well, your views on that may depend on whether you're a Brit, a Yank, or neither. This podcast, The World in Words, and the World Radio Programme, The Big Show, they're both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org. The pod is at theworld.org/language. It's also at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I tweet a whole bunch of language stories. My handle is patrickcox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. There's also a Facebook page called The World in Words. And today, the entire pod is given over to a conversation with Lynn Murphy. She's a linguistics professor at the University of Sussex on Britain's south coast. And she has an alter ego, Lynnguist, as in L-Y-N-N-E-G-U-I-S-T, linguist. Get it? Yeah. Under that name, linguist, she blogs. The blog is called Separated by a Common Language. And I highly recommend it. For someone like me, who knows a little, but not a lot, about my native tongue and about linguistics. It's great. It's packed full of detail about the evolving differences between British and American English. The posts are linguistically rigorous. Well, to be honest, I'm guessing at that. I studied linguistics for all of one semester at college. But the posts are never jargony, which is often a problem in academic linguistics. They're comprehensible. They're smart. They're fun. So, I went to visit Lynn Murphy at the university there in Brighton, and I began by asking her exactly what kind of linguist she is.
I am a theoretical lexicologist, which means I think about how it is that words are organized in the mind, which the principles of that would apply to any language. But as somebody who teaches about how English works, I'm always attuned to how my language is different from those who I'm teaching, and how my language is changing all the time. I mean, as I'm talking to you, I can hear a half dozen things I'm doing that I wouldn't have done before I moved to the UK.
So. Oh, well, tell me a couple of them.
Well, I just said attuned, so I put a little on-glide, a y, at the beginning of my U instead of saying attuned. And I do hear myself doing these things. I'm not, in some sense, trying to do them, but as soon as I hear them, I notice them.
Mm. And when did you start noticing that?
Probably after I blogged about it, because I am dealing with these issues all the time. I do sort of become hyper-aware of them. I also become aware of them when I'm mocked for not doing them. So I know that I started adjusting my ah and my American ah in words like hot. I started adjusting that after I was mocked for saying box instead of box. So my box is somewhere in between the two now because of that.
I do that a lot too. I think I pride myself on being able to, you know, when I come back here, being able to at least cut out some of the most, don't want to say egregious Americanisms, but the most obvious ones are the things that I'm most likely to be mocked for, the old tomato or something like that. But there's no question that I'm really only getting rid of a very small percentage of the stuff that I picked up in the U.S. Do you find the same thing when you go back to America?
Yeah, the last time I got my hair cut in the U.S., I was asked if I was from England, which anyone from England would just, you know, roll about the floor laughing. My vowels are different enough that people recognize them as foreign, and I pronounce my T's in words like water and things like that. And so, yeah, I'm a foreigner now.
Water is a huge one. I've actually talked about this in the podcast because I one of the first jobs that I did when I came to the United States was I was a waiter. And I was trained to ask people, again, something I wouldn't have done in an English restaurant, ask people the first thing as soon as they sat down, would you like any water? And I would keep saying water again and again, and people would just look at me, what's he saying? Who is this strange foreigner? Until I trained myself to say water.
And so it was my first American word. I feel very... You know,
I think that's everybody's first word when they switch countries, because it comes up so often and it's so impenetrable, because really the only sound that's the same in the two versions of the word is the W. The first vowel is the same, the T is different, the first vowel is different, the T is different, and whether or not you say the R is different, I mean, it's a completely different thing. It's British water sounds much more like Walter, the name, to Americans, I think, and so it's a very confusing thing to hear in a restaurant.
Yeah, and because it's the first one, I mean, I immediately had the feeling that, my goodness, I really am I'm dealing with a foreign language. Or at least I'm dealing with something far, far more profoundly different than I believed before I was in America.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been doing my blog since 2006, and I've got probably nearly 400 posts, and I've been on Twitter for maybe a couple of years now, doing a difference a day, every day. I've not run out of differences yet, and I can't imagine running out of differences before I die.
So how long have you been in the U.S.?
You mean in the UK?
In the UK.
I've been here for nearly 12 years.
And what brought you here in the first place?
The job that I have at the University of Sussex.
And you have since married a Brit and have a family here. So
I have. I've even pledged my allegiance to the Queen and all of her successors and become a citizen. And I am the mother of a British person, which is a bit weird to have somebody who's so unlike me at the same time as being like me.
That's great. And of course, you use your husband very much as he's your favorite guinea pig or your favorite speaker, although increasingly less reliable as a British speaker.
He's always been somewhat unreliable because he's always been an Amerophile and lived for several summers in the U.S. So he's not the most reliable judge of his own language. But he's helpful at any rate, and he's a good straight man in the blog.
Absolutely, a good straight man in the block. But you might say that in Britain anyway, there's a sort of sliding scale of Americanism among all Brits. So there are some who use many, many Americanism or choose to use many, many Americanisms, and some who try as hard as possible to use none whatsoever, and most people are somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think also most people who are trying to or trying not to are usually somewhat wrong about what they're doing. I mean, in avoiding Americanisms, people often avoid perfectly legitimate English things to say. I mean, one of my favorite examples of this at the moment is the spelling I-Z-E or I-Z-E at the ends of verbs, where the British preference these days is I-S-E, and that's a very recent preference. And I have no doubt that it's because the two forms existed in the UK. The Z form was associated, or Z form was associated with America, and as soon as something becomes tainted as American, it becomes not good enough for English if you want to avoid Americanisms.
Mm. You've seen recent research that suggests that British English no longer enjoys this sort of snob status among Americans, that they're just as likely to like other dialects.
Mm. Well, one issue there, of course, is that Americans are notoriously bad at being able to sort out non-American English dialects. So Australians are confused with English people and English with Australians, which, you know, someone in England would, you know, finds unbelievable. Traditionally, English people go to America and everybody says, oh, I love your accent. Oh, everything you say sounds so intelligent. And they, I'm sure, enjoy that quite a bit. My husband, who has stayed in America for various periods of time, has definitely felt that he got a better class of girlfriend in America than he felt he could have ever got in England because of his accent. But these days, these things seem to be changing. And my husband, again, will tell you that when we go to New York, he's just somebody else now. Nobody treats him as special the way that they would have 15 years ago or so. And the research that I was discussing on my blog recently, I compared a study in 1985 where Americans were asked to listen to accents and give their opinion on them. And they saw a sort of standard British, you know, southeastern England accent as being very high status. They assumed that the person who spoke it was their better in various ways. They found it intimidating and uncomfortable to listen to. Nevertheless, they found it a preferable accent to their own. But another study that was from 2001 found that when Americans were asked to rate the status of people speaking, the North American accents came first, followed by the Australian, and only then by English. So that perception of British English as being the pure English, the English that has status, has definitely changed. And my favorite bit, although I think we have to take this study with a grain of salt, it was an undergraduate study at Brigham Young University, found that people who had not lived abroad found the English accent to be very statusful, and English people as being much more intelligent than people with American accents. But those who had lived abroad at least 3 months found the English accent to be the less intelligent accent between the two. And that was just a very striking result. It was the only significant result in their study of 4 different accents.
That may affect where I live next, I suppose. I thought, when I was first in the United States, it was made quite clear to me as a young reporter that my accent was definitely a plus. And people would say this to me. I mean, listeners were intrigued that I would be reporting on domestic subjects that had nothing to do with, you know, international affairs and just to do with their own domestic affairs that nobody needed a passport for. And there was genuine intrigue about that, but also just a sense, I think that made it important. If I was telling them what the state legislature in a certain state, you know, the decisions that they were making, and I was from the outside and I had a British accent, that made everything that much more important. Maybe that'll change, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, one does have to wonder why the attitude has changed, and maybe it's just familiarity, that it's not as special anymore. You hear a lot more British voices on the radio and on the television, and therefore they're just seen as normal people, which of course you are. But there are also other things you could wonder about in terms of the rise of American exceptionalism and American isolationism in recent years, could also have a hand in that.
And certainly, depending on where you are and what type of, I mean, now that I work for a radio program that is international in scope and focus, then it makes perfect sense to have a variety of accents and all of that. What about your American over here? I mean, I always remembered when I was younger that Americans would get a bit of a hard time of it from Brits, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. I always thought that Brits could be quite mean about Americans and the American accent. Has that let up at all?
Probably not. I mean, nobody, wherever they live, likes tourists. So, you know, Americans come over and they take up space, and the same happens with the British in New York. People get sick of tourists. I think the distaste for American accents, it's a personal thing. I meet a lot of people who say, oh, I love your accent, talk some more. Well, maybe not a lot. Not as many as you probably meet in America. But I certainly have things that I say thrown back at me, pronunciation of certain words or...
You mean people are trying to correct you?
Or imitate me in a sort of mocking way. There's an elderly gentleman I can think of who will throw my vowels back at me, and I have to say has had an effect on how I pronounce things. But at the same time, because I'm Northeastern, because I lived in South Africa before I lived here, I also get congratulated a lot on having a soft accent. So,
oh, they like that, yeah. Soft accent.
Yes, I'm not saying y'all, and I'm not, I don't have a twang, although sometimes they might say I do.
Yeah, Brits like to use the word twang. I've been told I have a twang.
Yeah, that's the general thought of American vowels, is that they're twangy, like a country guitar.
I don't know if this is a particular British thing to start a sentence with some kind of qualifier, but that's certainly something that you've looked at. You looked at this expression, I'm not being funny, but... which is apparently a cliche. I've not been around long enough to know that. It's used when you're about to say something controversial or possibly nasty.
Yeah.
Is that a not that particular expression, but the sort of qualifier ahead of it, is that a particularly British thing?
Not necessarily. You can come up with a lot of equivalent things in American. And Americans are, of course, notorious for putting in "you knows" and "I means," which are, you know, softening devices as well. The thing that gets me about "I'm not being funny, but" is just how... Oh, it's a very long thing to say in order to qualify something. So it makes a big deal out of qualifying something. And I haven't looked into it enough to say that, you know, the British do it more than Americans do in various ways. But it is a striking one, because often, you know, what comes next is either just very mean or very inconsequential. And the reason it came up in my blog was that my husband was saying it about things like how good the coffee was at a coffee shop. And I'm thinking, well, why do you have to qualify that? It might have something to do with the lack of a traditional complaint culture in the UK dealing with businesses. So you need that and as a way to soften up or warn somebody that a complaint is coming.
And when they say, "I'm not being funny," I don't understand the meaning of the word "funny" in that context.
It's a hard one to get a handle on, because there are a lot of uses of the word "funny." There's, you know, "funny strange" and "funny ha-ha." But there's also use of "funny" in British English, which means aggressive in a way. So don't get funny with me. So there's that sense, I'm not being aggressive, but there's also the "I'm not joking, but" sense of it. I think, to my mind, and I'm not a native user of this phrase, but to my mind, that phrase brings together the warning about non-humor and the warning about non-aggression.
All right. The non-aggression thing, that now makes sense. And that also reminds me of another one that I hear Brits saying all the time. I listen to a couple of British football/soccer podcasts, and constantly in these, when a team that is not very good is being discussed, when they're about to put that team in its place, that lower-ranking team in its place, they'll start by saying, "No disrespect to Team X," or, you know, "with all due respect to Team X." And then they go on to say something that completely disrespectful about Team X. And it's a form of politeness. I think it's believed to be a form of politeness, but to me it sounds rude.
Yeah. These kinds of things always remind me of a study that was done in South Africa about miscommunication between native English speakers in South Africa and Afrikaners. And the Afrikaners always felt that the English were two-faced, because they'd say one thing and mean another. And that's sort of the perfect embodiment of that, saying "I'm not being disrespectful" and then disrespecting or saying "I'm sorry" and not meaning it at all. And I think one sees some of that in American culture. I mean, it's a general part of the English-speaking world, but one sees it, you know, writ large in British culture.
So you come across this a lot there's all of these funny things about how within sort of management structures, whenever a British manager says something like "interesting idea" or something, it means that they think it's completely uninteresting. I don't know how real that is.
Yeah, there are lots of lists of translations like that going around the web. And a lot of people read those sorts of things, those lists, and say, yes, well, we do that in America too. You know, you say "interesting" when you mean, you know, laughable. But there is a sense in which that is much more pernicious, I was going to say. It sounds a bit of a judgmental word, but much more epidemic in British English interactions, especially at a certain sort of class level. And everything is about class in British English.
Absolutely. Tell us then more about the class differences over here. I mean, do you feel as though, as a transplanted American, that you have to learn not one but several languages, class-based languages?
As a foreigner and as an academic, I'm sort of in a class by myself. And so I can sort of interact with the middle classes and the upper middle classes and be fine. But it's something that Americans are not immediately sensitive to when they come over here, and it's something that you really have to grow a sense for. Because in America, class does matter in America, but not in the same class isn't the obvious cue that we use for people. We use where you live. Are you a hick or are you a town person or what ethnic group are you and things like that, rather than having a class identity in the same way. So Americans, everybody in America believes that they're middle class, no matter what their income is, no matter what their education level is. Whereas in Britain, the middle class is growing in terms of attitude, who believes they're middle class. But there is a much more entrenched history of people being working class, and that's who you are. And that's, you're not going to try to be anyone else. And all of that comes out in language. I mean, as soon as anybody in the UK opens their mouth, they are categorized in terms of their class.
I've also read on your blog something that reminded me of older times back in the UK when I was at college. All middle-class students sort of affected slightly lower status accents because they didn't want to own up to being middle-class. Does that still exist?
No, that's changed. I think we're sort of the same generation. That's what my partner would have done, and that's what people I know who are my age did, sort of in the 80s. But no, now the university students I see are very middle-class. They're aspirational. Most of my students, because of where I work, are middle-class. But you do see huge gulfs between those who come to university who are middle class and those who are not, in terms of the way they communicate and their attitudes about how they want to be seen. And yeah, I don't see the affectation of working class as much as you used to.
It's no longer trendy to be working class.
No, well, you've got the whole Chav phenomenon. People associate being lower class, working class, or in some cases non-working class, with having a lack of taste, really. In the 80s or so, you had, you know, characters like Billy Bragg and leftist politics making something of the nobility of the working class. And you know, there you had the fight against Thatcherism, you know, taking apart a lot of the supports that were allowing the working class to be a working class. So it was a much different political environment than it is now in the post-boom age.
Lynn Murphy, otherwise known as Linguist. I'll post a link to her blog, Separated by a Common Language. Just go to patrickcox.wordpress.com or theworld.org/language. And, you know, I think I'm going to let my conversation with Lynn run on into the next part. I've got some other stuff planned too, but there was a ton of other things that Lynn had to say that I think you'd be interested in. And on the subject of the next pod, it's not going to be until early September. I'm going on vacation, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. Bye, y'all.